We'll hear oral argument in the case of Connor against McBride. Ms. Wagoner.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good afternoon, Mr. Martin and my enthusiastic and able co-counsel. Kevin Connor stood trial for murder and the death penalty with attorneys who were ill-prepared, inattentive to the case, and ignorant both of the law of the case and the basic facts of the law, life of their client. They failed to conduct a basic discussion with the client concerning possible defenses of the case or his own life. They failed totally to investigate the case and approach the trial and the penalty with no strategy and a lack of understanding of mitigation. The problem is further compounded by the fact that the Indiana Supreme Court, in reviewing post-conviction, like the Virginia Supreme Court in Terry Williams versus Taylor, concluded that Lockhart versus Fretwell modified Strickland. We now know that it did not. Their decision to not investigate this case at the guilt or penalty phase was not reasonable. The Indiana Supreme Court applied a label of strategy in hindsight to a record made by counsel as the case progressed of ignorance and inattention. 5 months after being appointed to the case, Mr. Lozinski, who was co-counsel and had no training or experience in capital litigation, wrote a letter to lead counsel Rick Mendez, expressing his concern and dismay that they had no discussions about the case. Indeed, at post-conviction, Mr. Lozinski remembered no substantive discussions about the case at any time. Mr. Mendez did not respond to the letter, and Mr. Lozinski took his concerns to Judge Tranberg. It was still the end of August before any motions were filed in this case, and the funds for an investigator were not approved until September the 6th. After the investigator was hired, he talked to one of the investigating detectives on the case and interviewed one witness. He reviewed the police reports and wrote out questions and concerns that he had about the investigation, but his report was not furnished to counsel until the trial started, clearly not in time for counsel to have considered any of the information, much less developed a strategy. Indiana has among the most liberal discovery rules in the country, and had at that time. Counsel did not depose a single witness, interview a single witness, or talk to even people that they called at the penalty phase until the trial was underway. Mr. Mendez, trial counsel, who was supposed to be lead counsel, had told the Indiana Public Defender Council in June, in early June, that there was absolutely nothing to argue on behalf of Kevin Connor. That was before Mr. Connor was evaluated by any physicians, and long before Mr. Lozinski expressed his concern that there had been no meetings about the case, and months before Mr. Mendez's one visit to the jail to talk to his client. It is clear that Mr. Lozinski, who took over the major responsibility for both the guilt and mitigation phase, did not understand what mitigation was. The record supports that. He admits that he felt there were many things that he should be doing, but he just didn't know what to do. He had had no training or knowledge of capital litigation and apparently didn't read his own reports or the statute regarding mitigating factors.
You know, with respect to the failure to develop Mr. Connor's intoxication as a mitigating factor, there was some evidence of Mr. Connor's intoxication before the jury and the judge, wasn't there?
Yes, it primarily came in through Mr. Connor's confession. But counsel didn't even request a voluntary intoxication instruction in the guilt phase of the trial. and they didn't recognize it or develop it or urge it as a mitigating circumstance in the penalty phase of the trial. Mr. Lozinski told the jury at the beginning of the penalty phase that you've heard these horrible things that Mr. Connor did, now we're going to show you that he's capable of some good, that he has some value. They put on his mother and his stepsister and his stepfather and learned for the first time that Kevin Connor was adopted. If you look at Exhibit Z in the PCR record, you will see that Dr. King's report on page 2 actually contains the information about the adoption. So we have, and that report was dated September 27th, 1988, when the trial started October 3rd. You have to assume that counsel should have known about it and did not, just like they should have known about Dr. Fredrickson's report and did not. The picture that they portrayed to the jury, or attempted to portray to the jury during the penalty phase, was patently false. They were demonstrating, basically, that Mr. Connor had come from an idyllic Beaver Cleaver home when nothing could be further from the truth. The majority of his youth, he was exposed to a violent, abusive, and rejective stepfather. He learned that he was adopted from a cousin 2 years after his adoptive father had died. His mother, who was had only a fifth-grade education and was basically illiterate, reinforced that information in the most negative manner possible by referring to his birth mother as his real mother, and he was told repeatedly that he hadn't been wanted by his birth parents.
Is it your view that the evidence of the abuse in the home was so strong that it alone might have given the jury reason not to recommend the death penalty?
Yes, it certainly would have provided a context for how he got to the point that night. And if they had had the foresight to recognize the effect of alcohol, first of all, to have recognized that Kevin Connor was an alcoholic and his birth parents were alcoholic, and recognized the synergistic effect of alcohol on the various mental conditions he had, I think there's more than a reasonable probability that the jury, that the result of this case would have been different.
What mental conditions are you referring to?
He is grandiose. He had Dr. Price listed a virtual laundry list of various...
Dr. Price is a PhD?
Yes. He listed a virtual laundry list of disorders and thought impairments that combined with alcohol were like pouring gasoline on a fire.
How about the other three examining doctors?
Dr. Hull and Dr. Schuster examined only for sanity or competency.
What would have distinguished a mental health examination focused on possible mitigation as opposed to one limited to sanity and competence?
The typical evaluations at that time, particularly for sanity and competence, didn't really discuss family history, social history, those sorts of things. They looked for a disassociation, total disassociation with reality, an inability to comprehend what a courtroom is, what the function of the judge is, those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
Where an examination, you know, looking for mitigating factors would have been more directed toward the types of things that were in Dr. Price's report. Dr. King's report had a substantial amount of that information in it, but again, counsel both testified under oath that they had no idea that their client was adopted or that his home was abusive growing up. So they didn't understand or appreciate even what their own expert had provided to them. I believe that shows a total inattention to the case, a lack of understanding of the law, and a lack of understanding of how the law affected the available facts in this case. this court said just the Indiana Supreme Court also labeled the trial guilt phase strategy as holding the state to its burden of proof, which was reasonable. But just within the last week, this court in the Beard case specifically said the duty of a criminal defense attorney is not satisfied just by looking for ways of poking holes in the government's case. There must be a reasonable search for evidence that would support an alternative theory of the case. Mr. Lozinski, during his summation in the penalty phase, after the state's devastating rebuttal as a response to the few good deeds that they presented that Kevin Connor had done in his life, told the jury, "We need to keep Mr. Connor alive so that we can find out why he did these things. It's important that we know why." Obviously, Mr. Lozinski didn't understand that the fundamental responsibility of the attorney for the accused in a capital case is specifically to ask why. That's what mitigation is, to provide a context for the jury to receive the information about the client. Their failure to do so permeated this entire case and should entitle Mr. Connor to release. They obviously, since they didn't know he was adopted, failed to get any adoption records. They didn't get his
school records. How would that have made any difference?
By getting the adoption records, the PCR lawyers were able to discover the birth mother and to learn that his natural parents were alcoholics, which I think is a significant factor in his genetic makeup and his composition. And there are a lot of people that believe that alcoholism is a hereditary disease. Would have impacted that.
Where's the medical support for that?
There are people who believe. I didn't say there was medical support for it. I said there are people who maintain the theory.
There are people who believe we're constantly being visited by space aliens.
Well,
that doesn't
true.
Mean that it is the duty of defense counsel to make such an argument. Is there medical support for such a belief?
It's the duty of defense counsel to either investigate or to make at least enough of an investigation to determine that further investigation is unreasonable.
But
they didn't even discover he was adopted, much less that his parents were adopted.
How plausible do you think intoxication as a defense to the guilt would have been when Mr. Connor was cognizant enough, it would seem, to proceed from place to place, killing and then disposing of evidence?
It's always hard to guess plausibility with a jury, but the counsel didn't, it wasn't counsel that was developed anything about the intoxication. The court gave the instructions sua sponte. I think what's more important about the intoxication is that it is a statutory mitigator in the death penalty
mm-hmm.
portion, and it would have been important and appropriate for counsel to have begun laying the groundwork for that during the guilt phase. They didn't even recognize it.
Well, with that, I think just follow up on Judge Rovner's question. He seemed to be able to make decisions and move about without any problem during the course of the murders. So what is intoxication? How does that mitigate anything?
In the degree of intoxication with his mental state affected his judgment more than anything. You know, would it provide an absolute reason that he should be found not guilty of the crime? No. And that is not the contention of the defense. But it is, under the Indiana statutory death penalty scheme, a mitigator that impacted his decision-making and those sorts of things. The jury heard nothing about his level of intoxication, only his self-admissions as to, you know, he had this to drink here or that to drink there. The level of intoxication was equally available to counsel, and significantly what Dr. Evans opined was his probable range of intoxication was consistent with the level of intoxication found in the autopsy of Tony Moore, who had been drinking with him all night. So the evidence was clearly there and available. Counsel didn't understand it as, obviously didn't understand the availability, apparently, of the defense at trial because they submitted no defense instructions and didn't understand how it would work in the mitigation phase either because they didn't return to it there. They tried to portray him as just this loving, kind, wonderful person from just a wonderful, supportive home. That was a false picture being conveyed to the jury for no reason and inconsistent with the facts and circumstances that were readily available. You know, Debbie Scott admitted at length that she was terrified of her own father because he regularly, weekly, almost daily, went on these horrible binges where he became very violent and abusive, causing Kevin's mother to take Kevin and go hide in church parking lots at neighbors, families, and friends. Yeah. And that's a far different picture than, oh, here, it's such a nice, helpful, loving family home. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Wagoner. Mr. Martin.
May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court's denial of habeas relief because it correctly concluded that the Indiana Supreme Court had reasonably adjudicated Mr. Connor's preserved claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, as well as the freestanding claims that are brought on this appeal. Initially, with respect to Mr. Connor's allegations that trial counsel proceeded without a theory in the guilt phase, the Indiana Supreme Court reasonably concluded otherwise in concluding that the trial counsel's adopted a strategy of putting the state to its proof, and it was more than simply putting the state to its proof in a general sense.
But what evidence is there in the record that would support the notion that Mr. Connor's trial attorneys had any strategy whatsoever with respect to the guilt phase of the trial Mr. Connor's attorney says that both attorneys admitted there was no trial strategy, no guilt phase theory. By their own admission, they did not craft a defense theory. Counsel both admitted that there was no trial strategy. I mean, how can we talk about there being a trial strategy when they say we didn't have any trial strategy? I mean, one of them had been suspended for the 2 years. Does the record say why he was suspended by the court?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. No. I think you're referring to Mr. Mendez.
Yeah, Mr. Mendez.
And it's clear that in this case, Mr. Lozinski did take the lead and conducted the brunt of the tasks and accepted the, mm-hmm. the brunt of the responsibility. With respect to your inquiry, Judge, it's not an unfamiliar circumstance in post-conviction proceedings for defense attorneys to express some sort of dissatisfaction with their understanding, with their performance, after they have lost, particularly when something's at stake like a man's life. And certainly there was that kind of testimony in the post-conviction proceedings here.
But surely you're not going to stand here and argue that lawyers will go in and say, look, I'm an incompetent fool, an idiot with no strategy. I won't be having many more cases.
That's not my argument, Your Honor. What I am arguing is that the determination of whether there was a strategy, and in this case it's going to be more difficult, in cases like this it's going to be more difficult because this was the epitome of a hard case, both with respect to the guilt phase and the penalty phase of the proceedings. And I would just say, Your Honor, that the record of the trial court proceedings is what shows that there was, in fact, a strategy. And I think that what particularly underscores this is the opening statement made by trial counsel and the closing statement made by trial counsel. And I would I would say to this court that the strategy was definitely to achieve something that was probably not within great hopes that counsel could achieve.
Do you know that when I read Mr. Lisinski's closing argument, I went back to read it a second and a third time because, so help me, I thought it was a misprint and that it was the prosecutor. That's how odd his closing argument is.
The way that I would address that, Judge, is that the state's case was so overwhelming. Mr. Connor's confession was not only wholly taking responsibility for the murders, but giving significant detail about how he did it and also exhibiting a significant degree of callousness in the manner in which he committed the crimes. Beyond that, we have crime scenes that significantly and substantially corroborate his account of how the murders occurred. Beyond that, we have witness testimony stating that Mr. Connor, when he was not in a position where it was necessary for him to do so, admitted these crimes. And we also have eyewitnesses to the first murder that kind of triggered the whole sequence of events. We also have a witness that falls into that category that was able to identify Mr. Connor from the photo array and in court. So this was the epitome of a hard case. What trial counsel did here, and I think what can be divined from the opening and closing arguments, and then the manner in which the cross-examination was conducted and the testimony was elicited, is that, and it's not something that you even have to infer completely. I mean, trial counsel squarely states this, both in opening and closing. Opening is more general. Opening suggests that because Mr. Connor offered a confession does not mean that he is guilty of all three of these crimes. And he says it in exactly that way. He says he may be guilty of one, but not guilty of all. Clearly, trial counsel's strategy was to attempt to create reasonable doubt with respect to two of the murders. It was very difficult for trial counsel to even take a shot at convincing the jury that Mr. Connor was not wholly culpable for Mr. Wendland's murder because of all the eyewitness testimony. So what they attempted to do was undermine the jury's confidence in his guilt on the other two murders so that he would no longer be eligible for the death penalty. And in fact, in closing argument, after he elicited from Mr. Wolf that there were discrepancies in Mr. Connor's account of what he did after he shot Mr. Moore at Wolf Enterprises, this allowed an inference from the jury that perhaps Mr. Villa, rather than Mr. Connor, committed the Vosges murder at Tony Moore's house. Also, there was testimony that Mr. Moore had stabbed Mr. Wentland with the knife before the rest of the act that culminated in that murder took place, and urged the jury to infer from that that there was reasonable doubt regarding whether Mr. Connor actually struck the fatal blow with the knife. If counsel could have been successful in creating reasonable doubt with those two murder charges, then he would no longer be death penalty eligible. And he states explicitly in his closing argument, who is Kevin Connor protecting here? And then he suggested directly to the jury, Mark Villa. Mark Villa's testimony is the testimony that appears to be fabricated. This is what counsel is saying to the jury, and suggesting that Connor was in fact protecting Villa and that Villa was in fact the murderer. And while this is a stretch, Your Honor, it is not the stretch of arguing to the jury that Mr. Connor was too intoxicated to comprehend the consequences of his actions. And Mr. Connor not only demonstrated, and the evidence did not only demonstrate that Mr. Connor could move from one murder scene to the next and kill again, but it goes as far as to show why he did, and that he was actually taking affirmative steps to eliminate witnesses.
But, you know, given that intoxication is a statutory mitigating factor, shouldn't his attorneys have developed and presented evidence as to the degree of his intoxication for purposes of the penalty phase?
Your Honor, that is a different question. And I believe that in this case, and I'd like to return again to the strategy that I think is shown in this record. both with respect to guilt phase and penalty phase. And this is something also that can be divined from direct statements by counsel. Counsel approached this jury with the overriding value of preserving counsel's credibility to the greatest degree possible. He did not want to insult this jury's intelligence and directly told them so, because he was confronting the overwhelming nature of the state's case against him, as opposed to being seen by the jury as being in denial or trying to run from facts that they were not going to be able to rebut. And I think that both the manner in which penalty phase evidence was elicited and the penalty phase was conducted and the guilt phase are consistent with this theory that ties it together. And in the penalty phase, Your Honor, the chief allegation of deficiency here by Mr. Connor is that rather than attempting to present to the jury excuses for Mr. Connor's conduct, these lawyers took a tack that would probably have been much more favorably received by this jury, which was to show that despite these actions that occurred in one night, which was the result of drinking, and it was well presented to the jury that this was a milieu of, it was an environment, it was an atmosphere of youth that were strutting around exhibiting grandiose macho behavior. There was drinking, there was drug abuse, and there was brandishing of weapons. They knew what the environment was. They know, or they were presented with evidence that showed what led up to this. What counsel strategy was to, rather than present excuses, show that even though these actions occurred, that Mr. Connor had worth as a human being, that he had committed actions of good, that he had established relationships where he had shown that he had cared about other people, and that there were reasons to spare his life despite the fact that he was guilty of the crimes. And given the nature of the evidence in this case, I don't think that that's going to be a reasonable strategy in every case, but this is a different kind of case, and I think in this case it was eminently reasonable.
Would it have been better to pursue the degree of his intoxication, given that intoxication is a statutory mitigation factor? I'm asking again. I'm asking the same question again.
And I guess that goes to whether counsel was deficient for having done so. I don't think so. I think it was a judgment call. Clearly, that was something that they could have done. But one problem with that, Your Honor, is that I'm still unclear, after reviewing the efforts that were taken in post-conviction, as to how they would have done that, other than what the jury was already presented with, which was Mr. Connor's own account of what he had drank and Mr. Connor's own account of how intoxicated he was. In post-conviction, that is precisely how Dr. Evans came up with an estimate of how intoxicated Mr. Connor was.
There was no blood test. Well, he wasn't arrested for some time after the event.
That's correct, Ron. I think it was Mr. Connor's counsel may correct me on this. I believe it was something like 2 days after the murder.
So there was no objective way of determining his level of intoxication.
You would pretty much have to credit Mr. Connor's account, which the jury was already apprised of. And I'd have to also add, with respect to the penalty phase, that, first of all, the evidence does not show the kind of horrific background that a jury would have considered mitigating enough to make a difference in these crimes. And in fact...
Yeah, but here you have, the stepfather gets on the stand, doesn't even admit to having arguments, let alone engaging in violence with his family.
Your Honor, I would submit that he did, in fact, testify on the stand that he had been a heavy drinker and that it had caused arguments and dissension within the home. I don't think that he testified
That doesn't rise to the level of the abuse, the violent behavior, the horrendous kind of stuff that was going on in that household, does it?
Your Honor, I think that's where I would differ with that characterization of the record. I think that there could have been testimony or evidence presented that there had been some violence in that home. But maybe two occurrences would have been supported by testimony where it was Scott who had become drunk and struck his wife. Mr. Connor's mother. There is no evidence in the record that Mr. Scott was ever physically abusive or violent with Mr. Connor, with the exception of a report in Dr. King, or an account by Mr. Connor to Dr. King in his report, where there had been an altercation, and my reading of that report suggests that Mr. Connor had struck Mr. Scott, and then in some kind of a physical altercation that ensued, Mr. Connor's arm had been cut.
Forgive me, but I thought I recalled reading about beatings and, you know, his stepsister being beaten and hiding in...
I do not recall any account...
And,
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't recall any testimony by the stepsister that she had been beaten. There were accounts, for instance, of neighbors and family friends who would say that Mr. Connor and his mother came to their home after Mr. Scott had hit Mrs. Connor, something like that. And, and there are some instances, but not many, in the record, alluding to that sort of thing. So to the extent that trial counsel should have put that on, and I still contend that because Mr. Scott had favorable testimony to give about Mr. Connor, and the record otherwise showed that there was an amicable relationship between Mr. Connor and Mr. Scott, I would say that that was a judgment call, but even if it were a bad judgment call, Your Honor, that would not survive the prejudice prong of Strickland in determining whether this jury would have taken that evidence and made a different determination about the relative weights of the aggravators and the mitigators. I think that the district court's examination of what the Indiana Supreme Court did in adjudicating these claims was correct, and that that court reasonably applied the two-prong requirement of Strickland to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims, and therefore these claims are without merit for habeas review under 2254D. I would just like to...
Could I just ask you this? Is it true that the investigator wasn't asked to interview the state's witnesses?
I do not recall a reading of the record that includes a statement that he was not asked to interview the state's witnesses. I think that my recollection of his testimony was that he attempted to interview the witnesses, and I know that the counsel gave an account of who he actually interviewed, and I do not have a precise recollection of who he did and who he did not. But I don't recall that he was asked by counsel not to interview the witnesses.
You would admit, I take it, that the investigator did very little indeed here. Well, maybe you won't want to admit it.
I think I would have to agree that he did not do a great deal of witness interviewing. I think that there was a great deal of examination of discovery materials and also a counseling with the attorneys about the import and the scope of the state's case. And so to that extent, I think that the investigation was fairly thorough. And I think also with respect to the investigation for the penalty phases, counsel was apprised of the gist and substance of everything that Connor contended on post-conviction review and then in habeas review, that it should have known before it presented its mitigation case. Dr. Price's testimony adds nothing that would be of significant additional mitigating weight to what counsel was already apprised of. And,
wow.
And that is that Mr. Connor was antisocial in his tendencies.
Well, he had 31 different mental health diagnoses, didn't he?
Dr. Price stated that he could potentially have as many as 31. And when he talked about that, it was in the context of this discussion about multiaxial diagnosis, which apparently was either new or not in vogue yet when Mr. Connor's initial examinations were conducted. So the nuances that kind of an evaluation might apprise someone of still boiled down to the same point. He was antisocial in his behavior. He had grandiose thinking. These were things that Dr. Fredrickson noted in his report. And I think Dr. King made diagnoses that were similar. So in terms of what they could have presented to the jury and what the jury would have made of that evidence is arguably not mitigating at all, but further aggravating, Your Honor. Um, The state would urge this court to affirm the district court's decision, and if the court has no further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Ms. Wagner?
Judge Rogner, the record does reflect the reason for the suspension. Mr. Mendez testified when asked that he had been suspended for a misuse of client's funds.
Could you raise your voice a little bit?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, and I know it doesn't carry well. I forget that sometimes. With respect to counsel's contention that we don't know how hard the case, or that this was a very hard case, and that it would have been impossible for counsel to have taken a different approach, it's impossible to make that statement because of counsel's failure to investigate, failure to appreciate, and failure to meaningfully test the state's case at the guilt phase. And
what would you suggest as a trial strategy?
I think a lot of questions could have been asked. The eyewitness testimony concerning the stabbing of Wentland, for instance, is confusing and conflicting as to who did what and the possibility of yet a third person there. Clearly, Mr. Connor was involved in that. Counsel conceded that at the beginning and the end, but then he kept saying, well, we don't really know what his involvement was, but he did nothing during his cross-examination to establish that. With respect to the Tony Moore situation, there actually is a statutory mitigator that talks about if the victim was a co-participant in the circumstances. With respect to the Villa murder, clearly the physical evidence at the scene where his body was found, or excuse me, not Villa Vogue, did not match at all Kevin Connor's confession, nor did it match any of the civilian witnesses who said that Connor never left Wolf Enterprises after Moore was shot. And a great deal more could have been
done.
Your
defense would not be that he didn't do it.
I think that would be an implausible defense. But certainly it would be a reasonable question to ask if you, as counsel investigating a case, came to the conclusion that your client was admitting responsibility for a murder that he obviously couldn't have committed, being that of Vogue, why would he do that? Why would he come in and confess? Why would he protect somebody else? Just asking that question, I believe, would have opened up a treasure trove of information about how he was as a child, how close he was, how he did these things with a limited number of friends. The state contends that it was a decent strategy to concede the murders in the guilt phase, and indeed there are cases where it is a reasonable strategy to do that. But then, if their strategy in the penalty phase becomes wholly unreasonable because the presentation in the penalty phase of simply good acts committed by Connor definitely, clearly, and unequivocally opened the door for the state to come back with more acts of violence committed by Connor. If their strategy was to confine Connor's bad acts and the jury's knowledge of Connor's bad acts to that particular night, then what they did was totally opposite of that, and it's unreasonable. Under the presentation that they gave to the jury. The violence that Mr. Connor experienced is no less important or less traumatic whether Mr. Scott actually hit him physically or not. Mr. Scott continually abused him, telling him he understood why his real parents gave him away. He didn't understand why his mother had adopted him. He learned as a standard that it was okay to beat up on your partners. He hit his cousin. Mr. Scott hit Kevin's cousin with a board, terrified his own daughter. I mean, that is as devastating and emotionally traumatizing as if he had been beating Mr. Connor on a daily basis. There is absolutely no evidence in this record that the investigator that was hired ever met with or had a meaningful discussion with either attorney on the case. The evidence is pretty clear that he presented a report that was dated the day trial started. We don't exactly know when counsel got it, but presuming they got it that morning, it could have been there's no way it could have been of much value to counsel. Lozinski expressed frustration at saying that he found it very difficult to get Mr. Campbell, the investigator, to do anything in the case. I think it's clear that even their investigator didn't do anything. Mr. Martin makes the point that counsel had all this information available to them. The Indiana Supreme Court found that they should have known of the existence of Dr. Fredrickson's report. They both admitted they did not, even though it was mentioned in letters and testimony. And it's pretty clear, upon a review of Dr. King's report, combined with their testimony at PCR and the evidence that they presented, they didn't even know what their own expert's report contained. I think this case smacks of inattention, ineffective counsel, and Mr. Connor is entitled to relief. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wagner. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until next week.